This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Conan O'Brien is celebrating his 10th anniversary as the host of Late Night with a primetime special that will air next Sunday on NBC. Sure, now many of us think he's incredibly funny, and we think that his show is a good reason to stay up late and cheat on sleep. But when he was hired in 1993 to replace David Letterman, who had moved to CBS, few people thought he'd last this long. O'Brien had written comedy, but had no on-air experience. As a Harvard student, he edited the humor magazine The Harvard Lampoon, then he wrote for Saturday Night Live, and was a writer and producer for The Simpsons. But you could tell he wasn't used to being in front of the camera. We invited Conan O'Brien to look back on the past 10 years. First, let's hear a clip from a recent monologue.
Man, if this is possible, it's getting crazier in California. That place is retarded now, I believe. I mean, they just really are. It's just the whole state of California. You've seen my impression, right? That's my impression of the state of California. The whole state's gone mad. Well, it's getting even weirder now. It's been reported that some of Arnold Schwarzenegger's opponents have been circulating naked pictures of Arnold on the internet. That's right. Yeah, true story. Yeah, in a related story, Arnold is leading the other candidates by 4 inches. Get it?
Conan O'Brien, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your 10th anniversary. Did you expect to celebrate a 10th anniversary of Late Night?
I actually thought we'd make it 8 years and then the whole thing would fall apart. So this is quite a shock. That was always my plan. I'm very specific in my schemes and plans, and I always thought 8 years, 4 months, and then the whole thing goes under. You know, to tell you the truth, I never thought about it that much. I always took it one show at a time, and I'm still doing that. And I think that's how you get anything done, is you just, all I ever thought about from the first day was, let's just see if I can do one show. And then after that, I said, okay, let's see if I can do two. Let's see if I can do three. And now it's been about 1,800 shows.
But who's counting?
Exactly, yeah. I'm like a man on one of those New Yorker cartoons on the little island, you know, counting the days. It's been 10 years now, and it's pretty mind-blowing.
Can you give us something of a preview of the anniversary show?
The anniversary show is going to be a 90-minute extravaganza. It'll be a juggernaut. I'm just trying to think of great words to describe
stupendous
90 minutes of television. Right, yeah. Stupendous.
Are you usually confident or insecure when you're facing a big event like your special?
Here's my formula. I like to be extremely insecure, and then that insecurity drives me to work very hard and worry a lot, and that causes me to almost over-prepare to the point that right when I get up to the event, I'm ready to go and I'm feeling pretty good. And that's kind of the formula I've used for everything in that I've done in show business. Last year when I hosted the Emmys, I did that. I was very worried about it, worked very hard until just before I went out to host, and I knew that I had all my ducks in a row and I was ready to go. And I was heavily medicated.
Yeah, are you good at dealing with anxiety, even if you're putting that anxiety into the work?
Yeah, I have. You know, what helps me, anxiety works for me when it spurs me to work and to think hard. This is a terrible person to quote, but I'm going to do it anyway. Someone told me once that Charles Manson
we get all of our self-help adages from Charles Manson.
Charles Manson once said about comedy. No, he once said, you know, fear is a good thing because it makes you hyper-aware. And I thought, well, that's interesting because I found that anxiety and fear to a certain degree actually helps you prepare and helps you focus and helps the creativity. The problem is, like anything else, is that if it gets out of control, suddenly you're nervous, you freeze up, you're not thinking, and you don't do your best work. So it's just trying to hit that right balance where you're you're kind of worried about it, and you're thinking about it a lot, and you're obsessing about on it, and it's making you creative and not getting in the way.
In order to prepare the special, since you have a lot of clips from the history of late night, mm-hmm. You've had a look back at a lot of your old shows. What mm-hmm. are some of the things you see when seeing yourself or just seeing, you know, like sketches or interviews on late night that you didn't see at the time when you were watching the show?
It's funny, when I look at the tapes from September of 1993, I'm able to almost look at that Conan O'Brien as a different person. I'm able to disassociate myself with that person. And I have to tell you, that Conan looks really young.
Yeah, right.
That Conan, I had just turned 30, but I look 17. And I have the voice of a 14-year-old girl, and it's funny because I look at that person now, and I think to myself, you have no idea what you're in for, because I always knew that this was going to be hard, and I always knew that it was going to be an uphill climb to replace Letterman from complete obscurity with no experience, but. I think I had to go through it to know exactly what a titanic effort that was going to be. And so when I look at that guy, I kind of feel sorry for him. I think you don't. But at the same time, I think it's nice because I can look at him now and say, don't worry, it's all going to work out.
You know, when you heard your voice back then, you didn't think you sounded like a 14-year-old girl, did you?
No, then I thought I sounded like Barry White. you know, it's only later on that I see, oh, okay, I was pretty green. I was very raw.
No, no, and, you were very pale, which you still are.
I was very pale. That actually didn't get any better. That's still, unfortunately, lack of melanin. There's nothing medical science can do about that. And but what I like when I look at those old shows is that we from the very first day we were swinging for the fences, which I like that. I like that we always tried, I thought, fairly innovative, strange, weird comedy pieces, even when it wasn't working or it wasn't very popular with people. And now some of those routines have become very popular, and they've almost become, you know, mainstream in a way. And it's fun to look back and see the show when we were trying these things for the first time, and it was, you know, looked very bold.
What was a high point and low point of the very first show?
First show, I remember the, there's a lot of, I don't remember there being a low point in the first show. The first show I remembered feeling, I was so happy to do it because they announced that I had the show in late April of 93, and I went on the air in September, and for those few months in between, I was very famous, but for no reason. And I hated that. I hated being famous for no reason, and everyone was looking at me as if to say, what are you going to do? Who are you? Mm-hmm. What is this? And so I was so happy to do the first show because I thought, now, love me or hate me, they know what it is I do. Do you know what I mean? They can actually look at the work rather than just staring at me for no reason. And so I remembered really liking the first show. I think the low point was probably when the show was over, realizing that there was this elation that we did it. We did our first show, and then realizing this doesn't end. I have to do this tomorrow and the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. And this is much harder than I ever thought. And the high point was probably singing Edelweiss with Tony Randall at the end of the show.
Well, you know, when you started to do the show, you had to create a TV version of Conan O'Brien. I mean, I'm sure you're kind of yourself
right.
on TV, but not completely. You have to be a little larger than yourself when you're doing the show. So can you talk a little bit about figuring out who you would be, for instance, in your opening monologues?
It's funny because a lot of the good stuff, if we want to qualify any of it as good stuff, is unconscious. Never set out, you know, these silly, weird, abstract things that I do in the show, like pretending to pull my hips with string or, you know, licking my eyebrows or growling. It's stuff that I was probably doing on a playground when I was 8 years old, and it just comes out of me. And I guess if I have any persona on the show, it would probably be the guy who has mistakenly been given a late night talk show, but he's going to do it anyway. You know, I always like, right. I mean, I don't come out in an appropriate authoritative way. I jump around, I hiss at the camera, I hide from the camera, I'll start weeping openly. I mean, I do all these things that a talk show host probably shouldn't do. And for some reason, that seems to work for me.
Now, you said you were probably doing a lot of the things that you do now back in your playground days. I doubt you were rubbing your nipples in the playground days.
Yeah, I was not rubbing my nipples. I don't think I had nipples then. They were added later. It's a surgery you can get in Sweden. But I was doing the Bob Hope growl very, very early. And I was...
This is the growl at attractive women.
Exactly. I was doing that to girls when I was 8 years old because I thought... I think I saw Woody Allen do it in a Woody Allen movie and later saw Bob Hope do it. And I thought, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. So I was, playing the part of the sort of bungling Lothario when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. I just, basically any comedian, whether they know they're going to be a comedian or not, they're working on their act from the minute they're conscious.
So it's kind of like you knew as a kid that you weren't like the leading man guy, that you were the comic lead.
Yeah, exactly. I think everybody unconsciously or subconsciously figures out very early how they fit into the puzzle. And I think very gifted athletes, they figure that out on some level at an early age and they start asserting that part of their personality. And, people that are very verbal figure that out early. And I think when I was very young, okay, what do I have? You know, I come from a big family. I'm one of six. All my other brothers and sisters have these different talents. What do I have? And how do I fit into this? You know, and on the playground, what can I offer? What's different about me? And I think it's a defense mechanism. And you figure out very quickly, what do you have in your arsenal? And I figured out that I could make people laugh fairly early. I never decided that would be a career. That it wasn't till I was, I think, halfway through college that it started to occur to me that maybe I could make a living doing something like this.
Let's get back to Bob Hope for a second. You mentioned that, the growl and, some of the self-deprecating stuff came from Bob Hope. Did you, as a kid, when you saw him after seeing Woody Allen, did you then go back and watch early Bob Hope movies and think, like, this is an interesting guy, I'm going to learn more about him?
Yeah, it's funny because my discovery of Bob Hope was backwards, which is I first was introduced to him, like a lot of people in my generation, as he's that guy wearing a blue blazer who's telling kind of corny jokes in these sort of late, mid-70s, late-70s TV specials. Do you know what I mean?
I sure do.
And it was only much later on that I discovered him in movies with Bing Crosby, and I saw, basically that he created... I think he created this prototype character that a lot of people have borrowed from. And Woody Allen admits that after he saw Bob Hope, he knew what he wanted to do for a living. That the confident / cowardly guy on the make and who will betray his best friend to get what he wants. And when I saw Bob Hope do that, I sort of slowly started to realize that, gee, a lot of the people who I really enjoy watching, Peter Sellers is a good example. Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther movies. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who's, completely wrong and completely confident. And I always thought that was a comedic persona that always appealed to me is... for some reason, I think it touched sort of or tapped into my idea of who I was, which is I'm the person who's going to growl at the actresses on my show and hiss at them. Or if Harrison Ford's on the show, I'm going to have a mock bravado with him that completely collapses the minute he gives me one of those cold stares. And it's, you know, it's a sort of comedy dynamic that's old and tried and true, but in a talk show format, it's a little different.
Did you behave around girls as a teenager the way you do around the real attractive actresses on your show, where you'd growl at them and be like the comic guy?
Sadly, yes, because, and I'm being serious about that, because if you're, you know, if you grew up the way I did, you know, and you're fairly repressed Irish Catholic, you're too scared to try anything. Do you know what I mean? You're not going to try anything. So it comes from an element of truth, which is you're attracted to them. You're fascinated by women. You want to make them laugh. You want to get a reaction from them. You want them to like you. So there's all the bag of tricks, but then God forbid any of them ever, you know, made a move towards you or showed interest, then you'd run for the hills. So that's, you know, kind of where the whole persona came from. You know, I think you always had that idea with Bob Hope that if he ever got Dorothy L'Amour, he wouldn't know what the hell to do with her. You know, he'd be panic stricken.
How much did the Irish Catholic background figure into your identity? I mean, how repressed were you?
Or, you know, turning into a therapy session. I'm going to get a bill from NPR. The repression's all there. It's real. It's you know, it fuels the depression and the self-hate. It's a wonderful, it's like a Rube Goldberg device, you know. The depression drops down onto the self-hate, which triggers the self-loathing, which then fuels the anger, which curdles into comedy, and then it sadly leads to a slow, quiet drinking problem. It all fits. It's like a Swiss watch, the way it interrelates. I joke a lot about the, you know, there's an element of truth to everything I say, and then I exaggerate.
Right.
Because, yeah, a little repressed, but, you know, I didn't take it too far. You know, I had a good time, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
I can't stop doing that. I'm sorry.
Well, you have all these weird, you have a whole repertoire of weird laughs.
I know. I'm sorry.
and I figure you must have watched watched a lot of horror movies, too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I watched everything. I just literally watched everything there was to watch. And I took from everybody and everyone everywhere. Commercials, you know, jingles, a funny thing I'd see on a Christmas special. If you see something you like, you grab it and you throw it into the stew and you mix it up. And I remember when we first started doing the show, one of the first characters that I did on the show was called the Laughing Genie. And it was just, I was a genie that just laughed way too much. You know, that hands-on hips Yul Brynner. I collect all those things. And one of the things I always do is if I pass a mirror, even if I'm brushing my teeth in the morning, you know, I'm busting stuff out. I'm trying things. I'm always trying to make my wife laugh. And it's a sad, never-ending cry for help. If there are any listeners out there who can please help me, someone help me.
Here's a clip from one of his opening monologues earlier this year. O'Brien is jumping around and meowing like a cat.
I'm the late-night cat. Meow! You'll never hear that phrase again, I promise you. You'll never again hear the late night cat. That was a terrible mistake. It'll never happen again. It'd be great if NBC seized on that and started using it. And after then, a late night cat. That's as much promo time as I get now. It's just Conan. Jay Leno's got ball. He's also got this and he's got that. And then Conan. They get an auctioneer in there just for that line. We bring the auctioneer in for the Conan promo. All right, here it goes.
Okay. Let's analyze exactly what's going wrong there. You know what's funny is that when we first started doing the show, I was trying so hard to do the monologue correctly and do a good job and be a professional. And, and what's funny is that at a certain point I gave up, and I think that's when the monologue became compelling and original, is because it does rely on good jokes. I do try and get the best jokes I can, and I have very good monologue writers who do a really good job. But where I really come to life is when one of them completely misses. And that's where I light up. Because if a joke misses completely, a lot of the other late night shows like to have music play in between the jokes to kind of fill it out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I always told the band, never play anything in between the jokes, because there's nothing funnier than a comedian saying something and then there's absolute silence, especially, I think, with me, because I've built up this persona over time. I mean, I think those are the best monologues, is when people see me backed into a corner and I have to fight my way out.
Can you think of a good example of one of those?
Sadly, I can think of hundreds and hundreds of examples. I think, you know, sometimes what I'll do if a joke gets absolutely nothing, and I'll tell a joke and it gets absolutely nothing, is I'll pause and then stare into the camera, and then there'll be a little bit of applause afterwards, and I'll stop the audience and say, I don't need your pity. <You know? laughs> And then I'll pause again and say, actually, I do need your pity. And then they really applaud, and you're just playing a game in a way. I'm turning the audience into a foil, and we're just going back and forth. And, you know, I think the best thing that I ever did is the minute I got to, years before I got the late night show, when I first got out to Los Angeles to be a television writer, the first thing I did was I went and I signed up to take improvisational classes in improv. And I studied that for years, and I really loved it. And it's the best training I think a talk show host can have, because I love to listen to what's going on in the show and then respond in the moment. And audiences know when something's spontaneous. They just do. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It can, you know, it's not a terrible disaster if we try something at 12:30 at night on my show and it doesn't work.
And then you can make fun of it afterwards.
Then I can make fun of it, and I can acknowledge. The most important thing to do is acknowledge that it didn't work. Don't pretend it worked and keep moving, because that's where I think you alienate people.
Now, that gets to a change that's recently happened in the past few years, which is that, you know, for the first few years of the show, you had Andy Richter as your, mm-hmm. you know, your sidekick, your co-host.
Yeah.
And he's acting now. He was back mm-hmm. on your show recently, and he'll be with you for the 10th anniversary show.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But it's harder, I imagine, to reflect on what's happened on the show or what's gone wrong and make a joke about it without somebody there to work off of, to bounce it off of.
It's funny, because at first I thought, well, we're going to have to get somebody else. And I was dreading that, because I thought Andy was not there by design. Andy was a happy accident. Andy was someone who I interviewed for a writing position, and we hired him. And then over the course of the summer, just realized this person needs to sit next to me. This is just, we have a nice chemistry. So I didn't want to go and try and have lightning strike again in the same place, and I was skeptical about that. So when Andy left, I didn't really know what to do, and I thought, well, let's just have a period of mourning, where there's nobody there, because I thought the worst thing in the world would be if Andy leaves and people tune in the next night and someone else is sitting in his chair. It's going to feel wrong. It's going to almost feel disrespectful. So we didn't do that, and then I started to realize over time that I was looking into camera, and I was talking right into the lens, and I was using the audience and my producer and everybody around me as kind of my collective foil. And it felt like, well, this is a change, this is very different, but it works in a different way. And we went from being open to the idea of a sidekick to realizing, well, gee, it's been 3 years since he's been on the show, and we've done a lot of really good work, and things seem to be all right, so let's keep going.
There's a lot of, you know, rip from the headlines type of humor, as they say, in your monologue. Do you read the newspaper every day?
Yeah, I read the New York Times, because that's what gets delivered, and then I'll flip through you know...
I like the way you're not taking responsibility for the fact you're reading the Times. You're reading it only because it's delivered.
Yeah, it's delivered. I've asked them not to bring it. I've said, please, don't bring the New York Times. No, that's the one you know, I get at the house. And so that's the one I read most thoroughly.
Right.
And then I'll read USA Today because they have the color pie charts. And that really breaks it down nicely for me. And then after that, we have so many different papers. Then, you know, I'll pick up the Washington Post and see what catches my eye. So you look through a bunch of different papers, and so do all the writers. It is funny, though, of all the shows, of all the late-night shows, I think ours is probably the least topical of all of them. It's the most abstract. We do a lot of comedy that's just about people in bear suits and with puppets. And, you know, there's a... Our show has topical comedy because it helps fuel ideas every day. But I'm shocked at how... I think there's a good 70% of our show that you could look at over the years that relates to absolutely nothing. It's like we've created a little wonderland of characters and oddballs, and it's almost like a Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's like I often think we're more like a children's show sometimes than a late night topical talk show.
Well, let's talk about the most famous character that's come out of the show, which is Triumph the Insult Comic Dog.
That's right.
Which is I think a Robert Smigel.
Yes, Robert Smigel.
Robert
the
Smigel creation
of the show,
right? Mm-hmm. And who does the voice for Triumph? Mm-hmm. And who had a big fight with Eminem. Did Smigel tell you that he was going to do that? And did you say, no, Eminem's going to fight you for it. It's going to be dangerous.
No, I knew that he was going to do it. And most people react pretty well to Triumph. That Triumph became so popular that we started getting celebrities requesting Triumph. John Bon Jovi called up and said, please, can Triumph come over and insult me? I mean, we literally had people requesting it. It was a high honor. So Eminem, I think, was the first person to get, you know, angry at the puppet, which I love saying. I love that someone can get angry at a puppet.
I figured he'd never seen the show and had no idea what was going on. He'd never seen your show and had no idea what Triumph was.
Right. I have no idea. I have no clue. Yeah. But, you know, it's possible he thought he was just being attacked by a man with a rubber dog on his fist. I love that his bodyguards intervened, and that was the best part. So it's a good thing that he had three bodyguards on hand to protect him from the rubber dog. But
can you talk about the evolution of Triumph on your show?
Yeah, I might get this wrong because things get complicated, but the best that I can remember is that we used to do a recurring routine on the show about talented animals from the Westminster Dog Show. And we would say, you know, some of these animals are really talented, and we actually have some of them here in the studio, and we would cut to a little puppet theater, and we had these little dog and cat puppets that would do silly little tricks like, you know, spinning a plate on a stick, or doing card tricks. I mean, it was silly, and it was people seemed to like it. And I guess there was the idea to do a comedian, and, you know, so Robert said, well, what if, I think he was an insult comic, and so Robert just started playing around with that, and we tried that, and right away it was very funny, you know, and my favorite part about Triumph, and I don't know why, but Triumph has the voice of a Ukrainian woman. You know, you think it's like, it's so nice to see you, yes, yes, oh yes. And I have no idea why, but apparently, you know, this is an immigrant who made his way to the Borscht Belt, and and it was funny right away. And then we started, I think initially Triumph just insulted me, and then we thought, that's really funny, let's bring Triumph back and have him insult celebrities who were sitting next to me. So after I was done interviewing them, I'd say, would you like to meet Triumph the Insult Comic Dog? And then he would start yelling at William Shatner and say, look at you, Shatner, what has happened? You're fat pig, Shatner. And then we realized, okay, this is working really well. People really love this. And then we sent Triumph to an actual Westminster dog show where he attacked different different dogs and started humping real dogs. And we got one of the dogs to hump him and got thrown out of the Westminster dog show. Thrown out, kicked out, because they saw this. And those are not people with a sense of humor. So men in bow ties, who later ended up working for M&M, converged on Triumph and threw him out of the Westminster Dog Show. We snuck back in with fake credentials the next year, got thrown out again after shooting a remote. Those did very well. And then there was a period of time where people thought, well, Triumph has run its course. That's it. I think it's done. It's not going to be that funny again. And then someone had the idea, one of our writers noticed that there was this long line outside the Star Wars premiere of Star Wars fans waiting to go in, all dressed as the Star Wars characters. And so someone had the idea, let's send Triumph there. So we sent Triumph with some of our writers, and everybody wrote lines. And that, I think, and I am not an arrogant person, but I do think Triumph in line attacking different Star Wars fans is probably the funniest 10 minutes of television that's been on the air in the last, you know, 5-8 years. I mean, it just, we showed that and the reaction was amazing, and we're going to be showing a big piece of that in the 10th anniversary show. It's really one of the one of the greatest things I ever saw, and I love television. I've watched a lot of television, and I just thought, you know, Triumph is talking to a man dressed as Darth Vader, you know, and insulting him.
What did you say?
And the guy as Darth Vader is explaining which buttons do what. Like, this button is my transporter, and this button does this, and this button does that. And Triumph says, yes, yes, and which button do you press to call your mother to come pick you up?
My guest is Conan O'Brien, and he's celebrating the 10th anniversary of Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And so there's going to be a 90-minute primetime special Sunday night, September 14th.
It's going to be a sex extravaganza. I just made that word up, but I think that's what it's going to be.
You have guests on the show each night. And, you know, we have guests on our show all the time, of course. And when we don't know much about somebody who we're thinking of having on the show, one of the producers will often call them up and pre-interview them. And we always feel like almost guilty about it, like we're kind of almost like auditioning them, you know,
right,
for the show. So we feel a little uncomfortable about it. But we always say, well, I bet the Today Show does that and more. You know, I bet, you know, David Letterman, I bet Conan O'Brien puts their guests through real hoops before they get on the show. What do you do? How do you screen guests before they're on the show if they're not people who are really known to you?
Well, we do have segment producers who talk to them on the phone, and you know, some people think, well, but that's, you know, cheating, because shouldn't it just be a real conversation? And what I believe is that it has to be there's a happy medium, which is, I don't believe in trying to turn normal people or people who aren't necessarily raconteurs or funny people into comedians.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm uncomfortable having people tell a prepared whopper of a story with a big punchline at the end, because a lot of people can't do that very well. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
They're it's, you know, you've seen people try, and I think it's painful. So what we like to do is we like to have areas that seem profitable. Do you know what I mean? That mm-hmm. seem promising, because I think when you do a television show or a radio show, whatever you're doing, it should be a slightly heightened reality. Do you know what I mean? It shouldn't just be the conversation that I would have with somebody if I bumped into them on the subway and was going to ride 40 blocks with them. It should be better than that. And so in order for it to be better than that, I want to make sure that I don't go down blind alleys. And when you do a pre-interview, you find out what's just going to go nowhere. Do you know what I mean? And you know, if J.D. Salinger decides he wants to come on my show and talk about what he's been working on for the last 30 years, and I say, great, well, first of all, I want to ask you, tell us about your house. I don't like talking about my house. We're not talking about my house. Well, I don't want to have that moment on the air. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I want to make sure that we've at least found out this, you know, J.D. Salinger loves making balloon animals. And he's really funny talking about balloon animals. And so I'll bring that up. And then he and I can probably have a really great 3-minute moment talking about balloon animals.
I love your description about how the interview, the conversation you have on TV should be a heightened reality. It should be better than the conversation you'd have on the train with someone. But when you run into somebody on the train, do they expect that you're going to have that kind of heightened conversations that they're used to hearing you do on TV?
Well, first of all, let's get something straight. I will not ride the subway.
I knew as I was saying that you probably don't ride
it's
the subway.
It's ridiculous. I've had a strap handle put in my limo so I can have that subway experience, but in the comfort of a limousine. I don't even know. Subways, are they steam-powered still? I don't remember.
Do you have homeless people asking you for money in your limo so you could get the full experience?
We hire a guy to act like a homeless person, and I pay him $85,000 a year. He's a graduate of Brown University, and it's a good job for him. The misconceptions that people have about me, one is that for some reason people think I'm not very big. So whenever I go anywhere, all I hear is, oh my God, I can't believe you're this tall. You don't look this tall on TV. How are you that tall? Why do you look so small on TV? And the other thing is that I'm so up and sort of, I think on television I'm a cartoon character. You know, I really think that I've got the big hair and the big grin and I jump around a lot and I'm kind of like this hyperactive Bob's Big Boy character. And so when I'm walking down the street or if I'm on the subway or if I'm taking a cab, a lot of times people ask me, what's wrong? Are you okay? You seem sad. And I'm not sad. I'm just neutral, you know?
Yes.
My mouth is a straight line. There's no downward curve whatsoever. It's an exact straight carpenter's line. Because I'm thinking and I'm, you know, wondering what I'm going to have for lunch or where I'm going to take my dog for a walk or, you know, where my wife and I are going to go on vacation. It's just like I'm just completely neutral. But when people know me from the television show, neutrality reads as depression.
So it's not so much the conversations, it's how you look that gets people.
Yeah, it's funny because I actually make an effort when I'm talking to, if I'm talking to someone on the subway or if I'm talking to someone, you know, when I'm getting my bicycle repaired at the bike shop, I actually make a little bit of an effort. You know, I'm always trying. And especially if someone's laughing, I think that's probably reveals how needy I am. No matter where I am, if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and my car breaks down, and someone from AAA comes on a country road to fix it, and I say something and the person laughs, I start working it a little bit. I want to get that second laugh, and I want to get that third laugh. And it's the AAA guy, and he doesn't need to hear this. But, you know, it's hard to turn that off. You know, I'm always killing with, like, Chinese food delivery guys, you know?
Now, you're married now, and mm-hmm. I believe you're expecting a baby?
That's right. Yep, sometime probably around October 15th.
Do you feel ready to be a father?
You know, I don't think you're ever ready.
Yeah, right.
I'm excited about it, and I'm ready to try and be a good dad, but I'm very aware that around October 15th, I am going to be hit over the head with a giant 2x4. And that I have no idea what it's going to be like or how I'm going to respond. I'm going completely on faith that it's going to be great because I think it will be. I just believe it will be, but I have no idea what it's going to be like. I think people with children just know something that the rest of us don't know.
Right. I guess you're about to find out what that is.
I'm about to find that out, and then I'll come and tell you.
Thank you. Yes.
I'll report back because it's very intense and crazy, the idea that I'll, along with my wife, will be responsible for a human life.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that, let's face it, you got married just to prove you're not gay.
Well, that was the idea. The idea was, this was all my manager's idea. Uh-huh. He said, we've got to prove. we've got to prove you're not gay. And so we tried this, and that didn't work, apparently. And then we decided, okay, now we got to crank it up and have, we got to have the baby. So a baby was purchased and will be, quote, born on the 15th. Because I ain't having sex. That creeps me out.
How did you end up doing a lot of jokes about not really being gay and stuff like that on your show?
It just seems so absurd, and it goes back to, it's something that, it's so funny because there's a lot of people out who are uncomfortable with, you know, the idea of someone, you know, even implying for a second that they might be gay, and, you know, they're, and I've always... was not uncomfortable about it at all. Do you know what I mean? I've sort of just thought it's, you know, the it's just another way. It sort of fed into my whole insecure, bumbling, you know, guy who's constantly trying to convince the ladies that he's got it going on. Do you know what I mean? Just so every now and then in the monologue there'll be a huge news story that's going on that day, and I'll come out, and of course, folks, you all heard the big news, and then I'll just pause, and I'm straight, you know, and for whatever reason, people just laugh, and it's, you know, but who knows? I don't really know what, you know, it's going to be years before I really know what my sexuality is. Ultimately, it's not important. We're all people.
Well, Conan O'Brien, congratulations on your 10th anniversary, and congratulations on your forthcoming baby. And,
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing the special. It sounds like it'll really be great. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.